طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week, our Palestinian voice is that of Sahar Francis, an attorney with Adamir, a Palestinian prison support and human rights advocacy organization. She spoke at the Harvard Law School, and we were there to record her presentation for This Week in Palestine. Here is the first-hand account of the stark realities of Palestinian life under Israeli military occupation. Here is Sahar Francis.
Justice for Palestine is an organization dedicated to raising awareness about the Palestinian experience and the Palestinian struggle here at the law school. Today we're joined by Sahar Francis, the general director of Damir, Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which is a crucial Palestinian civil society organization based in Ramallah that does prisoners' rights and prisoner support. Damir has been around for 25 years, this year actually, and has faced incredible repression from the Israeli occupation authorities, from a lot of different sources, and it's really an incredible honor and a really special opportunity for us to meet with them here in person. So today's presentation is going to touch on topics including human rights, occupation, military law, military court systems, and specific mechanisms like administrative detention. So just briefly, administrative detention is basically a system. It's a holdover from the British Mandate period in historic Palestine, where you can be detained indefinitely without being presented with charges against you, without being arraigned, without having a hearing or an opportunity to defend yourself, on the basis of secret evidence, and remember, it's indefinitely renewable. So this is just one example of the tools of the way in which the prison system is used as a social control on the Palestinian community. It's been used against elected officials like Hadid Lajarab, as well as student organizations like the Progressive Student Labor Front at Biazeit. And Sahar will help us understand more of what our counterparts in occupied Palestine are experiencing and provide some historical context and updates from the front lines of the struggle for Palestinian liberation. If you'd be interested in getting involved in events like this in the future, please do leave us your name on the sign-in sheet, which will be going around. And without further ado, please help me in welcoming Sahar Francis.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thanks for organizing this event. It's very, very interesting and important for me to meet law students today and to discuss actually how the occupation managed since 67 till today to use the law as a tool of oppression against a whole society and a tool of control. And this is what exactly the Palestinian prisoners' case and the military court system in the occupied territories reflects. Let me start with the point that the Israeli occupation forces, when they entered to the occupied territories, at the first 3 months, actually, they implemented the international humanitarian law, the Fourth Geneva Convention on the occupied territories. But very soon after, they changed their minds and they started to implement their own military orders. And they established their own military court system that is still controlling every aspect of our life under the occupation. So they made the military governor the legislator. So all these military orders are coming from the military governor who controls the occupied territories. They established the military court system, and they established a civil system, civil administration system, in order to deal with all the daily civil issues like registering newborns and getting permits to work inside Israel, to travel abroad, to build your house, and to register your land, and all other civil aspects, which wasn't supposed to take place because the occupiers are not supposed to become the like to replace the state in the occupied territories and to have jurisdiction all over these civil issues, unless if it's very needed for the development and for the interest of the local people, which the Israelis totally violated in their military system. So immediately they started to issue these military orders. Today they are 1,700 military orders. They automatically illegalized any political party in Palestine that was existing, that was supposed to be established. So today, any political party in Palestine is declared illegal, still including Fatah, the main party of the PLO that signed the Oslo Agreement back in 1993. So theoretically, they can arrest the president himself, Abbas, for being the head of the Fatah party. This is correct as well inside Israel. All studential movements in Palestine are illegal because all these student movements are associated with the political parties. So being a student activist in any university, like Colin said, for the Beer Zeit University, it's not just that it could subject you for administrative detention. You could be imprisoned for 1 year, 2 years if you are active under the like Qutb, the left union for the left groups in the university, or the Islamic Jihad or the Hamas group. Any civil humanitarian aid or charitable organizations that the Israelis claim that they are affiliated with political parties would be declared illegal. And this has happened a lot after 2000, after the Second Intifada. Hundreds of charitable organizations were declared illegal in order to affect their humanitarian aid and their work with the community. They interfered in the health sector, in the education sector, in every aspect of our daily life in order to control our life. We started with five different military courts in the occupied territories. Currently, there's just two, because after the Oslo Agreement, you know, they withdrawled from the main cities in the Palestinian occupied territories, but they are still controlling more than 62% of the occupied territories. And these two military courts actually focusing not just on the security cases. You know that according to the international law, they have the right as occupiers to have military court system and to prosecute civilians and militant people under the occupation if they are involved in very security threatening cases that immediately cause a huge threat to the forces of the occupation. But the jurisdiction of the military court is much wider beyond this strict definition by the international law. Geographically, the military courts have extrajudicial jurisdiction. So any Palestinian or international that commits any violation according to these military orders outside the occupied territories, he could be arrested and prosecuted for these acts. So many students who went to study in Russia or in Pakistan, in Sudan, in Yemen, in any other country, and came back, they were subjected for imprisonment because of their involvement in these universities in these countries. As threatening, there is a crime that it's actually very wide, threatening the security of the area. We call it, this is the basket crime that can fit inside any activity that they claim based on secret information that you caused a serious threat to the security of the area. There's no clear definition what it means the areas and what it means the security of the area. Actually, by this system, also there's like the most problematic issue for me as a lawyer working in this system for 20 years is the definition of the crimes and how they submit the charge sheet, the language of the activities that they describe. It's very vague. For example, throwing stones. They never put in the factual part of the charge sheet when you throw the stones, exact time, where, exact place, so you can defend yourself properly. You can argue that I wasn't there, I was with my family, I was with my friends in that place, and so on. Also, as I said, it includes almost every aspect of our daily life. It's not just defining the most security serious cases. So journalists would be arrested, political leaders, students, children, like even teachers in the universities were subjected for imprisonment, Palestinian Legislative Council members, and so on. Currently, there are 6,150 prisoners in the Israeli prisons, but in all these 50 years, more than 750,000 Palestinians were arrested, which means you cannot find any Palestinian house that they were not experiencing the imprisonment at least once against one family member. In some cases, you can find five people from the same house arrested in the same time. Out of these 6,000, still there's 300 children under detention and 460 administrative detainees, 62 female prisoners, and 11 Palestinian Legislative Council members, and 9 of them, they are under administrative detention. In order to explain more how they use it as an act of control, so for example, in the first Intifada, when all these demonstrations and peaceful resistance started, very massive in all of the Palestinian villages, immediately the mass arrest campaign started, and they started to use a lot the administrative detention. So in the first Intifada, more than 10,000 people were arrested under administrative detention. Most of those were like activists on the ground, initiating demonstrations and organizing the neighborhood committees that they were taking care about the daily life of the people under the first Intifada in the OPT. So these military orders that, as Colin said, came from the British Mandate security regulations were developed later on in the Israeli system and in the military system and were adjusted as local law. Based on a secret information, any military governor can arrest anyone for up to 6 months, claiming that you are a threat to the security. So the only suspicious that you would be getting in this order as a written document is that you are a threat to the security, nothing more than that. You wouldn't know at all what's the kind of activities, what's the proofs, and so on. So you have to defend yourself against something that actually you don't know what it is exactly about. And it could be renewed indefinitely. There's no limit how many times they can renew this 6 months order. It applies for children. Currently, there's one child under administrative detention. In 2010, they arrested 25 children under administrative detention. And it could be used against everyone. For the first time in 2015, they used it in East Jerusalem as well against children. Since the beginning of the occupation, they never used administrative detention against children, but they did. They arrested five children from East Jerusalem in 2015, 2016, for up to 6 months under administrative detention. The longest period, continuous period, that a Palestinian detainee spent in administrative detention was 8 years. So you should know that also sometimes they keep you 4 years, 5 years, they release you for 4 months, 5 months, and they re-arrest you. We have cases that people so far spent 13 years and 15 years in and out. And in all this period, maybe they spent 2 years outside of the prison without knowing when you would be released and what you are supposed to do in order to put an end for such harassment. The administrative detention as well could be used in the same time of the prosecution. I'll give an example of one of our, the media officer of Al-Damir, Hassan Safadi, that currently is under administrative detention. Hassan was arrested in the 1st of May 2015. After he came back, 2016, sorry, he was visiting, he was attending the Social World Forum in Tunisia. And he was coming back to the occupied territories when he was arrested. He was under interrogation for 31 days. Then they decided to prosecute him for his visit a year before to Lebanon, because Lebanon is an enemy state, according to the Israeli laws. So any Israeli or any Palestinian resident of East Jerusalem, because they have the permanent residency, they cannot visit Lebanon. This is what they claimed. They accused him of visiting an enemy state. When they submitted the charge sheet, we managed to release Hassan on conditions. One of the conditions was paying a bill of 5,000 shekels. So his father went to pay the money. In the same time, they issued administrative detention order to keep Hassan in detention because they failed, based on this accusation, to keep him in detention. So they used the administrative detention. We ended up, Hassan was under two different procedures. He was under 6 months of administrative detention and facing a trial in the same time. At the end, for this crime, he was convicted for 3 months imprisonment, which he already spent while he's spending the 6 months of administrative detention. But his administrative detention was extended twice. So he spent 1 year and a half. He's supposed to be released in the 8th of December 2017. This is how it works. This is how they use the system, actually, in order to affect. And at the end of the day, all what was Hassan involved in is sharing in different conferences in the name of Al-Damir. This is also reflects how they try to undermine our work as human rights organizations. Maybe in our case, they cannot declare that Al-Damir is an illegal organization, because on the level of the funds and the relations, they cannot prove that we are affiliated with any entity, and it's clear where we get our funds. They cannot claim we are getting funds from terrorist organizations. So this is why they use other techniques. They raided the office in 2012, stole 5 computers, 2 cameras, and destroyed most of our files. And then they arrested the legal assistants for 10 months in administrative detention, Hassan for 1 year and a half. Now the other field researcher in Jerusalem, Salah Hammouri, is under 6 months of administrative detention. Khalida Jarrar, that used to be the ex-director of Al-Damir as well, and now she's a Palestinian Legislative Council member and a board member in Al-Damir, is under 6 months of administrative detention. 26 journalists were arrested this year, most of them under administrative detention. So also the way how it's very easy legally to arrest people under this system enables them to arrest hundreds and thousands. Even in the time of Oslo, they used administrative detention. They arrested 850 activists in the Oslo time that they were opposing Oslo from the opposition side under administrative detention. Some of them spent 4 years in administrative detention. Later on in the Second Intifada, before the Second Intifada started in September 2000, we had 4 administrative detainees. Immediately in the first month, it jumped to be 40. Then in the first 3 months, it's started to increase. We ended up in 2002, in March 2002, with 2,500 administrative detainees. Like in March 2002, when they reoccupied the Palestinian cities, In less than 2 weeks, they arrested 15,000 men, Palestinian men, from all of the cities. They kept most of them at least for 3 months in order to figure whether these people could be accused, whether they want to use administrative detention, and so on. And then, for example, Ofer, one of the main detention facilities now in the occupied territory, it's very close to Ramallah, but they deal with it as part of East Jerusalem, so they enforce the families to get permits to reach Ofer, still even if it's physically in the occupied territories. It was hosting more than 1,500 detainees in very, very bad conditions because it wasn't a prison. Ofer at that time was just a military base for vehicles, was prepared for hosting tanks and military vehicles. So because they arrested 15,000 people, they didn't know where to put them. They started to use Ofer, and they held 750 people each in the garage of the tanks in March in Palestine. It's very similar weather to here. And it was very horrible conditions for at least 3 months. When all the human rights organizations started to petition the High Court to try to develop the conditions. Going back to the... I'm sorry, there's lots of details to discuss about the issue of the military court systems, and I know most of you are not so familiar with such a system, and we cannot enter in all of these legal details about the procedures, the fair trial standards, and how it's contradicting the international standards, but I would just make a bit comparison in order for you to understand a bit how it works and how it's actually causing discriminating policies between the Palestinian local community and the settlers who are in the occupied territories or any other Israeli that would be arrested for the same reasons under the civil system. So in the military court system, it started with totally different procedures when it comes for the length of arrest under interrogation, comparing to the international standards and the Israeli standards on the length of the trial itself and the sentences and so on, and also the procedures themselves. First, you should know that we have two different legal systems in the same place. Like settlers who live in the occupied territories are not subjected to the military courts I'm describing. If they commit any crime, even against a Palestinian, like killing a Palestinian, they would be brought to inside Israel to be prosecuted according to the Israeli criminal system and not according to the military system. So by itself, there's an apartheid policy from the beginning in differentiating between these two communities. According to the military orders, up to 2012, actually, they were enabled to arrest anyone for up to 8 days without any judicial review. 8 days, you can stay in the detention facility. They can do whatever they want till you reach the judge after 8 days. Where in Israel, it was 24 hours always. According to the international standards, the shortest, the better, to bring someone for judicial review about the initial order to arrest someone. It was also applying for children. They were having children for up to 8 days without any judicial review. Just on 2012, they started to change. Now it's 4 days. Still for children that they are more than 14 years old, it's 4 days. Those who are less than 14, it's 48 hours. But it could be still extended for like 69 hours. Where in Israel, for children less than 14, it's 12 hours that they should be brought to the judicial review. The length, the total period of interrogation, it used to be 6 months. In 2012, they made it 75 days before submitting the charge sheet, but it could be extended up to 6 months again. But first it was 90 days plus another 90 days, another 90 days. Now it's 75 and it could be extended. Where in Israel, it's 30 days. In the security cases, like the dangerous cases, it's 35 days, and it could be renewed for up to 60 days, but not 6 months, definitely. The ban on lawyer visit. You should know that all this period under interrogation, you can spend without any legal counseling under the military orders, because it's enabling them to ban a lawyer visit for up to 60 days. Almost the most important period of the interrogation you can spend without getting any counseling on your rights in this sensitive period. And of course, these interrogations take place in Hebrew, sometimes in Arabic. Mostly the statements would be written in Hebrew, a language that the Palestinian prisoners, especially the children, they don't read, don't understand, and they would be enforced to sign a statement that it's not in their own language. Then we have to fight in the court about the accuracy of this statement, and in most of the cases it would be dismissed because the interrogators would claim, we speak Arabic, we translated every word for the child or the adult in Arabic, and he signed, he understood what we wrote in this statement. Of course, under interrogation, there's lots of different forms of torture. In the 70s, 80s, it was very physical, severe torture. Then it developed to be more psychological. Still, they use very different forms of tying in very painful positions, sleep deprivation. Of course, the families are not allowed to visit at all in the time of the interrogation, and so on. So after finishing the interrogation period, you would be facing either charges or you would be sent for administrative detention. It's very rare that you would be released without anything. The level of convictions in the military court, it's 97.4.9 something percent. So it's mostly all of the cases would end up in plea bargain because the detainees wouldn't have trust that they can argue these cases in the, like, they don't expect justice in such a system. So they prefer to plead bargain in order to plead guilty in order to be sure what's the kind of sentence they would be getting and how long, and that's it. And to save all this horrible experience of the transfer back and forth for the trial procedures that can take 2 years, up to 18 months, and it could be extended, while in Israel it's 9 months where the trial should end. So in the military court it could be ended without any end, actually, and then you can spend 2 years, 3 years, back and forth in the buses and suffering from very bad conditions in the tour from the prison to the court, and so on. So this is one element why they choose to go for a deal with the prosecution and just to spend the imprisonment in the prison, and that's it. Actually, in the last couple of years, they tried to make some changes on the military courts, but we claim this is just for public relations because there was lots of condemnation about these military court systems, especially against children. It's not offering protection and real protection, neither for the children, neither for the adults in this system. So children, for example, up to 2012, they were defined as 16 years old. All those that they were more than 16, till 2012, they were treated totally as adults. Nothing special in their trial, in their interrogation, or anything. It didn't make a big difference when they increased the age to be 18 now, and they have a special court for military court for children, but it's not following the procedures according to the international law for child rights and the protections that it should offer. So, for example, there's no rehabilitation programs. The only sentence would be real custodial imprisonment in the military courts. They don't send a child for a closed center for rehabilitation to to like help him to spend these 2 years or 1 year instead of spending them in a regular prison and the rehabilitation. It's not different procedures. Still, they face the same military court procedures, even though just the only thing that they are separated now from the adults and the court hearing is closed, so there's no public there. So this is the only protection they offer, that no one would know about your case but just your family. But they are still getting the same sentences and the same treatment. The new thing, what happened in 2016 in the Israeli civil system for children cases, that they changed the military, the civil law. Before 2016 in Israel was, if you are a child under 14 and you committed the crime while you were under 14, you will never get a custodial imprisonment as a sentence. Any sentence would be just under a rehabilitation or police officer follow-up and so on, but not real imprisonment. After all these clashes took place in East Jerusalem and in other places and involving children with stabbing and other issues, they changed the law, and today they can arrest any child that he's under 14 if he committed one of three crimes, like killing, attempt to kill, and attacking in serious circumstances, and they can send him even for life sentences. And this is what happened with the case of Ahmed Manasra. Actually, Ahmed Manasra was the first boy. They changed the law after the case of Ahmed Manasra, but it was because of his case. He was less than 14. They claimed that he was involved in attempt to kill case, and they couldn't arrest him for life sentence, so they kept him in detention till the end of the trial. At the end, he was sentenced for 12 years, and he's spending now the 12 years, so then they changed the law. It's very easy to change the laws in order to adjust them to their own interest, in order how to make it more difficult, because in this law, the child should have a motivation, like for the activity he did. And of course, it's an ideological motivation, so you can understand that it's just applicable for Palestinians. Because Israeli Jewish boys, they would never have such an ideological motivations behind their throwing stones or attacking Palestinians and so on. So this is the hidden policy, how the law itself would be drafted in a language that it seems to be objective, but at the end of the day, there is something that enables to be implemented just for certain group, as so many other laws in the Israeli, either definitely in the civil system. I would just end with the issue of the hunger strike a little bit about what happened this year, because it was a significant issue for the prisoners' case in 2017. They were involved in a hunger strike of 41 days, demanding their own basic rights inside the prison. One of these basic demands was phone calls. So all of these Palestinian political prisoners are not allowed to use the phone while in prison to contact their families. So if they are not permitted family visits for security reasons, even if it's for 10 years or 15 years that you don't get family visits, you also are not allowed to phone your family, to have any contact with your family. So one of the demands was the phone calls, the health care, the education. Palestinian prisoners are not allowed to study and to continue studying in any of the universities, neither the Israeli Open University or any of the Palestinian universities, or the crowded conditions, and so many other daily life issues. Immediately when they initiated their hunger strike, the Israelis were totally against, and they were refusing to negotiate with the prisoners. It ended up just with promises that we will develop the conditions. Unfortunately, till today, it wasn't reaching any good improvement in the basic things that they were demanding. And hunger strike in the last couple of years was used a lot by the prisoners, whether individually, demanding the end of administrative detention, basically. Currently, there's one detainee that he's still launching his own hunger strike against administrative detention for the third week, and collectively as a movement against the conditions of the prisons. Sometimes it succeeds, sometimes not. Depends a lot as well about the support from the community, from the international level, from the Palestinian Authority and other official level like European Union or the UN and so on. In 2012, for example, it was more success, hunger strike, because these groups were more supportive on the international level, and they interfered, like the European Parliament and the Arab League as well. And it ended up with negotiations led by Egypt, for example, which this time didn't work in the same way. I'm giving this example to reflect how it's the people and the mobilization of the people that can make a huge difference for the issue of the prisoners in supporting their causes. And just to remind you that on the child issues, I'm sure you heard about the campaign No Way to Treat a Child that was last week, like a Congress woman here initiated a bill for the Congress requesting that there should be more like investigation in the fund that the United States gives to Israel, whether this fund is used to arrest children or not. And they're requesting to stop if this fund is used in some way in this system against the child detainees, so it should be stopped because it's a grave violation for the human rights and international humanitarian law. And I think this is a very, of course, we don't expect that this bill would be approved, but at least this is opens the discussion in such a high level about the rights of these children and, of course, about the military system and so on. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Sahar Francis, an attorney with Adamir, the Palestinian Prisoner Support and Human Rights Organization. Her presentation was followed by a question and answer period, and time will allow only for the handling of one question, but it is a very significant question and a beautifully crafted answer. The question comes from an Israeli student at the Harvard Law School, who had experience working in the Israeli legal system, including the Israeli Supreme Court. The question is from an Israeli occupier perspective. The answer is from the Palestinian occupied perspective, an example of the stark realities the people of the region face every day. First, the Israeli student's question, and then Sahar Francis's answer.
Thank you so much for your presentation. My name is Ayelet, I'm from Israel, and I worked in the Supreme Court for 2 years, and I also worked in government. And I know a lot of the problems you are talking about, and I do agree that administrative detention is a very problematic tool. I've seen it very closely. But I do feel that to some extent, there you should also note that we are talking a lot of the times about terrorist actions. And we're talking about political organizations and how they are illegal, but we are talking also about Hamas as a political organization. And personally, when I had a lot to do with reviewing these administrative detentions, and I think Israeli authorities are really trying, and I see in the Supreme Court there are a lot of cases, like you say, maybe too many, but still that are looking into the evidence and seeing if this is necessary or not. This is a tool that in a place in which we are dealing with terrorism, that is the way to deal with. I think also in Israel, and I've been doing a lot of human rights work also, there are tries to diminish the bad effects of it, but still it is a tool that is needed sometimes. And also a lot of the investigation methods that you mentioned were banned a long time ago by the Supreme Court. maybe the tying and the sleeping restrictions. And I know that sometimes there are claims that this is happening, and still the Supreme Court is very active in trying to diminish this. I do think that there it should just be noted, and also Israelis can be in administrative detention. I know it's not the same numbers, but still, I feel like it's a
huge difference of numbers. Allow me to reflect on this, please, because I think in the last 10 years of the High Court history, no one single petition of one Palestinian administrative detainee was accepted. And I'm guaranteeing this. It's also what happens there, also a deal, like the security would come and suggest for the detainee, accept another order, and this is would be the last order. This is how we end cases in the High Court. You should know that in these years, not more than four Israelis, one or two of them were Palestinian Israelis, were subjected of administrative detention inside Israel. One of them is a settler that he was for 9 months. When he was released, he was requesting compensation from the state, and he got it for the administrative detention. So it's not really clear, correctly to say that the High Court is objective. No, it's not. I'm presenting in the High Court, and I see how they review. The secret information is the magic word for even the Israeli High Court. And if we want to talk about terrorism, I don't think even Hamas, as a political party, and all the Palestinian political parties, they have a political branch that have the right to work and to act in the Palestinian society as a political, like we were signing an agreement to become a state. So we have the right to establish our own political system. This is, of course, not undermining our right as a Palestinians under the international law to resist the occupation. And this is not terrorism. So we also disagree about the terminology, about what terrorism should be defined. I totally agree that there were maybe crimes committed by Palestinians under the international law that could be prosecuted in military courts, but the Israelis expanded much beyond this clear definition of the international law. So when Israel decides to arrest 48 parliamentarians from the Palestinian parliament in 2007, in order to paralyze totally the Palestinian parliament, this is not fighting terrorism. This is clear interfere in the political life of the Palestinian people, of the self-determination, of the right of the people to decide who's the representatives of the Palestinian people in every level, in the internal level and the international level. This is not about fighting terrorism.
And there you have it. Sarhar Francis of Adamir speaking at the Harvard Law School. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.